them again, or you'll hear them for the first time, sorry. Welcome, everyone. I'm glad to see some familiar faces this morning, and hopefully we'll have some new people join. Another meeting of First Friday Breakfast Club. I'm Byron Huff, FFBC president. My pronouns are he, him, his. We're an association of gay, bi, and trans men. FFBC was formed in 1996 and is a 501c3 entity, making your contributions tax deductible. We would like everyone to mute your microphone also. I think some may not be muted, getting some background. This meeting will also be recorded. Since formation, FFBC has raised more than $400,000 of scholarships that are awarded annually to Iowa school seniors who have done significant things to reduce homophobia and educate the LGBTQ issues in their schools and communities. $3,000 scholarships are awarded regardless of gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, or other protected characteristics. The real strength of scholarship program, aside from recognizing and rewarding an often courageous act of the recipient, it is the opportunity for FFBC to send a representative to high school graduation ceremonies throughout Iowa, assuming we have live ceremonies again. Often in front of an audience and thinks they've never seen a real live gay person. Amazing to believe in this day and age, but in Iowa, you know, and other states. Anti-LGBTQ bills being proposed by the Iowa legislature is alarming for our community, which makes our work more important. You can make a one-time or recurring donation on our website, ffbciowa.org. The technology that allows for payment options is thanks to the generosity of Brad Holland, Joe Rates, and Ascendant Wealth Management. If you have not donated this year, I hope you will. You can designate First Friday Breakfast Club as beneficiary in United Way donations using Amazon Smiles, which is their way of giving back to the community. You can designate the donations go to FFBC at no cost to you. Our website, you can find access links to resources. We're continually adding content to our archived monthly newsletters and audio recordings of past speakers. So be sure to go to ffbciowa.org. Thank you to David Cotton and Nicholas Williams and Wade Peterson and Joe Rates for many updates to our website. Thank you for David Cotton and Nicholas Williams for hosting the Zoom meetings. Until the day comes when we can meet in person. I don't know when that will be. May not be this year, but hopefully. We would all prefer in-person meetings, and someday we'll be able to do those again when it's safe for everyone. In the meantime, we're taking advantage of virtual meetings by engaging speakers from locations outside of Iowa. The virtual meeting format also allows others to join us who would be unable to attend in person. We hope to offer a virtual option after we have resumed in-person meetings. Talking a lot. Keep in mind, you can share or forward the meeting invitation you received by email to others. They may appreciate the opportunity to hear one of our amazing speakers. At this time, we'd like to give new attendees of FFBC the opportunity to introduce themselves. We had this tradition during in-person meetings, but have not done it since going virtual. So it's not quite the same, but anyone that would like to introduce themselves, please unmute your mic and say hello to everyone. Okay, no one stepping up, although I was looking at the participants and I didn't see new people that I wanted to, you never know, may not have noticed them. A couple of announcements. There's an LGBTQ older adults conference, the Stonewall Generation LGBTQ Elders on Sex, Activism, and Aging on Tuesday, May 18th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Go to the One Iowa website and you will find information about it and how to register to attend. It's a virtual meeting, I believe. And now I have Tim McMillan, and I don't know if Michael Eagle is also on the call this morning, but Tim McMillan has an announcement.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Byron. Wanted to touch base with you all and say good morning. You may have heard that this morning I'm representing Des Moines Metro Opera, and you may have heard that we are indeed undertaking an in-person season this summer with some live performances coming back. We're very excited about that. And that all starts in Indianola with the main stage season at the beginning of July, but wanted to draw attention to this group specifically about a special project that's scheduled to take place at Hoyt Sherman Place on July 17th. It's a very special performance of a work called Fellow Travelers. And that work, if you're unfamiliar with, although recently there's been some great information coming out about and some documentaries about this topic, but there was an era that paralleled the 1950s McCarthy era Red Scare that was called the Lavender Scare by historians following that time, and a period of time where, because there was suspicion that you could be easily influenced, working for the government in Washington, D.C. was a dangerous thing if you were even suspected of being a member of the LGBTQ community. And so there's been an opera based upon a book called Fellow Travelers. The opera was written in 2016, and it was premiered in Cincinnati and is going to be produced here in Des Moines this summer. So wanted to put that on your radars to let you know that it's an opportunity that we're excited about to see members of our community center stage in the spotlight. The other aspect is part of our Second Stages series, so it's a one-night-only performance in July on the 17th. The other opportunity that we're excited about is that leading up to the performance in July, DMMO is partnering with Capital City Pride and One Iowa to present some community engagement and education activities. And so we'll certainly share those as they become more finalized as well. But a screening of an Iowa PBS documentary called The Lavender Scare, with a panel discussion following it, speaking specifically about workplace problems or workplace discrimination for the LGBTQ community. And hopefully being able to hear from the author of the book, the composer of the opera, through a speaker series and other opportunities as we get into July as well. And I know Byron will probably mention that we're also hoping in July to be able to provide a member of the creative team to speak to the First Friday Breakfast Club. So wanted to introduce the idea to you all and let you know that it's an opportunity coming in short order to Des Moines, and we're very excited about it.
Well, thank you, Tim. We are looking forward to collaborating with you and promote your event, as because it's a very interesting, I think, of interest to First Friday Breakfast Club members. So we're looking forward to learning more about that. Next up, the newsletter was distributed electronically on May 1st to everyone on the FFBC email list. You can see the newsletter at ffbciowa.org, but please provide your email to info@ffbciowa.org if you'd like to receive our newsletters, meeting invitations, and other communications. The newsletter was sent with a link and inadvertently did not include the attachment. I feel an attachment is if you feel an attachment is necessary, please provide feedback via info@ffbciowa.org. Maybe we don't need to send the actual attachment because you can just hit the link, but not everyone. Sometimes there are some people that would prefer an attachment. Next copy of the deadline for the newsletter is the second Monday prior to the breakfast meeting. So the next deadline will be May 24th. If you have something you'd like to share, send a copy to info@ffbciowa.org for inclusion in the newsletter. Our next virtual board meeting will be Tuesday, May 11th at 6:30 p.m. Central Time. Please let me know if you'd like to participate, and I'll get you the Zoom meeting information. And now, Gary Moore will introduce our speaker this morning. Gary, you need to unmute your mic.
I was just calling myself. I'm mute. Good morning, everybody. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce Peter Montgomery. He is a senior fellow at People for the American Way, where he contributes to the organization's Right Wing Watch Project. He has a BA from Georgetown University, which he attended from 1980 to 1984, graduating from the School of Foreign Service in International Economic Theory and Policy. That's a nice BA background. He has studied the religious right movement and its right-wing political allies for more than two decades and written extensively about marriage equality, religious liberty, and other conflicts at the intersection of religion and LGBT issues. His reporting and analysis on the religious right movement and its political allies have appeared in numerous publications. He's appeared on MSNBC and National Public Radio, and has been cited as an expert in the New York Times, the Washington Post, as well as the New Yorker. As an associate editor for online magazine Religious Dispatches, he writes a weekly column on global developments on religion and LGBT issues. I look forward to hearing more about his expertise on the religious right and its influences on our futures. Please welcome Peter Montgomery. Nice meeting you. He's also, Peter lives in Washington, D.C., but he's coming to today from his Texas, where he and his husband are dealing with their mother's long-range planning, always a difficult part. So thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule in Texas today to join us.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me. It's really great to be with you. If I'm a little bit scattered, Gary just mentioned might help explain it, so I apologize if I'm not at my most focused. I am a lifelong morning person, so I won't blame the early hour. I love to be up early, and it's nice to be actually be invited to speak starting at 7 a.m. rather than showing up on a talk radio show at 9 or 10 p.m. long after my brain has shut down. So I'll talk a little bit about People for the American Way and our Right Wing Watch Project, the 2020 election, and the aftermath, including the Capitol insurrection. And then I'll leave plenty of time for questions and conversation, because there's, you know, a million things we could talk about when we start down the road of these topics. I do want to start by saying it was great to hear from Jonathan Wilson, who reached out to me to speak to you all. Like, I'm one of the very many gay people who were inspired by his very public coming out in the mid-90s in response to the anti-gay forces who were mobilizing in the school district where he was on the school board. And that was a few years ago. And as Garrett mentioned, I have been at this for a while. I joined People for the American Way in 1994, but I had been a member of it even before then, since it was founded in the aftermath of the 1980 election. When the modern religious right really first flexed its muscles as a political movement, electing Ronald Reagan and a wave of conservative centers. And back then, Norman Lear was a television producer coming off an extraordinarily successful decade in the 1970s, where he had numerous shows that were in the top 10 for years. And toward the end of the decade, he started watching some of the newly politicized televangelists, thinking he would do research to make a movie about them. But he was so disturbed by what he saw, including preachers praying for the death of a Supreme Court justice, preachers telling people that you couldn't be a good American unless you were the right kind of Christian, and you couldn't be a good Christian unless you shared his right-wing political views, that Norman thought it was more disturbing and gave up his plans to make a movie and started traveling around the country to meet with business and civic and religious leaders who worked with him to start People for the American Way. And Norman wanted to give voice to his fervent belief that patriotism and faith do not belong to any one party, and they certainly don't belong exclusively to the right wing, and that liberals shouldn't let the right claim them. And that's partly why our name is People for the American Way. We want to make an affirmative promotion and defense of the best American values, uphold the First Amendment, the separation of church and state, and the ideal of equality under the law. And we still believe that we the people means all the people. So 40 years later, monitoring and analyzing and challenging the vision and actions of the Christian right and its political allies when they threaten those constitutional values is still an important part of People for the American Way's work. I do a lot of writing for the Right Wing Watch Project, which monitors religious right and far right broadcasts, social media, and publications. Before the pandemic, I spent a lot of time attending right-wing conferences and rallies and protests. We publish daily reports on our Right Wing Watch blog, which I encourage you to check out every day. There's a number of video clips and reports and analysis, commentaries on what's being said and done on the far right. And then we publish longer analysis and reports analyzing what they're up to help ourselves and to help allies develop strategies to counter them. So today, People for the American Way and its foundation are led by civil rights leader Ben Jealous, who became president last year. He's a former president of the NAACP, was there at the time that the organization embraced marriage equality as a goal. I will say, too, that People for the American Way is proud of the fact that it was one of the very first non-specifically LGBTQ organizations to have its board endorse marriage equality. I think that was 1996. So today we have a number of other projects in addition to the Right Wing Watch work. We have leadership programs that are designed to support and elevate young progressive activists and public officials. We have a young elected officials network of some 1,300 people who've been elected to all levels of public office under the age of 35. We have training programs. There's a specific focus on reaching out and lifting up people of color, LGBTQ people, people who are often underrepresented in positions of power. So we're working hard to pass voting rights legislation and other democracy forms. We have a project to tackle systemic racism and reimagine public safety by supporting some bold thinking and reforms on policing. And since the Biden team came in, we've been running a campaign that we call Her Fight, Our Fight, which has been to rally around some of the extraordinary women of color that have been nominated to high-level positions in the administration who have been attacked and smeared by right-wing groups. So those are some of the things that we're working on right now that we can I can talk about any of those in the Q&A if you want. So to get back a little bit to the bigger picture, when Norman has talked in the years since about how he and his original founding partners were kind of naive in thinking that if they just put the spotlight on the rights extremism, you know, that would it would be enough to make them go away, you know, which Americans would shy away from them, and that in a few years their work would be done and they could close up shop. And it hasn't quite worked out that way. Over the years, a lot of people have been overly optimistic about the staying power of the religious right. I literally have lost track of how many articles have been written over the last couple decades in newspapers and magazines declaring that the religious right was dead as a political force. Every time a Democrat would win an election or some favored religious right candidate or cause experienced a defeat, somebody was writing that was signifying the death of the religious right as a political movement. But we always knew that those stories were wrong. Because they really ignored the fact that billions and billions of dollars have been invested over the last few decades in building a massive legal, cultural, and political infrastructure to support that movement. And that includes a huge religious and political TV and radio empires. It includes conservative Christian colleges and law schools, countless political organizing groups, and, you know, just the array of anti-LGBT groups could take a long time to run through. So, That is an infrastructure that, as we have seen, is not going anywhere, and it does not give up. When they lose an election or a court decision. And today we're seeing, you know, the Republican Party itself, you know, when the Christian Coalition was first started in the early 90s, with political operative Ralph Reed, using Pat Robertson's money and mailing list to get that started, he set an explicit goal of taking over the Republican Party from the ground up during the 1990s. And, you know, in many ways accomplished that. And then, we had sort of a similar effort, by the Tea Party, in, 2009, 2010. And now we're seeing in many places the Republican Party being transformed further by, Donald Trump and his supporters and the Republicans who are, unwilling or afraid to stand up to them. So that's, you know, a serious concern of ours, you know, because even before Trump came along, the party was far to the right of the Republican Party that existed, for example, in Congress during the time of Ronald Reagan. And now we see very few, elected officials, high level Republicans willing to challenge, Donald Trump's lies about the election. And in fact, in many states, they are using those lies to justify new restrictions on voting. That are designed specifically to keep people of color from voting and to help, you know, prevent future progressive victories at the ballot box. So, you know, it's kind of an amazing historical fact that while all that was going on, during the same couple decades, the pro-quality movement made the historic monumental gains we made in winning the hearts and minds of the American people, and you know, countless coming out stories, acts of courage by individuals like Jonathan, campaigns for non-discrimination laws, marriage equality campaigns, all those things give us opportunities to make ourselves known to family, friends, and coworkers. And that it created what, you know, are really historic shifts in public opinion about the legitimacy of our relationships and the importance of legal equality. But you know, as we know, throughout history, progress meets with a backlash, and that's certainly the case in our country today and around the world. And as you all know, someone referenced the legislation, the tip of the anti-equality spear these days is really anti-trans organizing and legislation. And that's very intentional. The right has chosen to make attacks on transgender people because they know that for now they have lost the battle of public opinion when it comes to equality for gay and lesbian people. And so, the trans movement hasn't yet made quite the same strides in public knowledge and public opinion, which makes the trans community more vulnerable. And I have been at religious right events where it's just very explicitly talked about in that way. It's a divide and conquer strategy, try to put in wedges in the movement, peel trans people away as a way to go after the movement more broadly, because we should be clear that they're not interested only in reversing and blocking gains for trans people, but they have never accepted the Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality. They want to overturn it. They want to go further. They want to reverse non-discrimination laws, and they certainly want to block passage of the Equality Act, which is pending in Congress, which would add sexual orientation and gender identity to the federal civil rights laws. You know, so they're waging this long-term and global campaign against what they put under the umbrella of gender ideology, which is a term they slap on everything from gender identity, sexual orientation, sex education, reproductive choice, anything that falls outside what they see as sort of traditional religious values on family and the roles of women and men. And during the Trump administration, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo really made that a centerpiece of his foreign policy. He actively organized at the United Nations to try to create new coalitions of countries opposed to any international recognition of reproductive choice or LGBTQ equality. And that's something I was watching closely during the Trump years. So I guess I'll come out to sort of a little bit of a long-term view of what brought us to January 6th. And we could go back many decades to the ways religion has been harnessed to support conservative political and economic forces. So I'm just, you know, there's a lot of trends that go back, but I'm just going to start around the 2008 election. Because the election of Barack Obama really spurred the creation of a lot of new coalitions on the right. On the religious side, it further erased whatever boundaries might have existed between what we'd think of as the traditional religious right groups and newer Dominionist Pentecostal groups associated with a movement called the New Apostolic Reformation. And this is a group of people who believe that they are modern day apostles and prophets who have been anointed by God to actually change, to transform Christianity itself and to bring whole nations into alignment with their biblical worldview. Some of you may have seen or read references to Seven Mountains Dominionism, which is a which is rhetoric that has been borrowed across the religious right, even by people who don't share this Pentecostal theology. And it says that there are seven mountains or spheres of influence in society, you know, like government, media, entertainment, business, and that the problems in the world are caused by the fact that godly people are not in charge of all those mountains. And so their goal is to get the right kind in their minds, the right kind of Christians to be running the shop in all those spheres of influence, to bring the countries in line with their biblical worldview. So those folks were some of the most prominent supporters of Donald Trump. White evangelicals generally were during his campaign and remained throughout his presidency his most loyal backers. You know, when he actually ran for president, we saw the two groups that were most being electrified by his campaign were conservative white evangelicals and white nationalists. And, you know, that mixture, that toxic mixture we have sort of seen, throughout, and particularly, in the wake of the election and leading up to the insurrection. There's a lot of overlap between there's a number of scholars who have really begun digging deep into and polling and characterizing the Christian nationalist movement and identifying the beliefs that that conservative white evangelicals have that make them so much a part of the Trump team. There's a lot of overlap between white evangelicals and adherents of QAnon conspiracy theories, a movement that began in the fall of 2017, building on early conspiracies like Pizzagate. And then something else that happened was the way that the COVID pandemic further radicalized parts of the religious right, who saw restrictions, public health restrictions on churches gathering as an attack on religious freedom, as a test case for shutting down churches altogether, which is what they think liberals want to do. Or at least what they tell their supporters that liberals want to do. And so the religious right and Christian media and Christian political organizations on the right have all become promoters of all kinds of anti-COVID conspiracy theories, including now anti-vaccine conspiracy theories. Liberty Council, which many of you may know is an anti-LGBTQ legal group that was known for representing Kim Davis, the county clerk, who refused to allow same-sex couples to marry, even after the Supreme Court's Obergefell decision. Liberty Council is now just kind of all out promoting every anti-vaccine conspiracy theory you can find about the COVID vaccines. And so that's in the lead up to the 2020 election, we saw increasingly violent rhetoric from all these segments of the right, from the religious right, the QAnon and other conspiracy theorists, militia-type groups like the Oath Keepers, violent sort of street-fighting groups like the Proud Boys. They were all part of the violence at the Capitol, but they were also all part of threats to violence that were leading up to it. And so while it was shocking to us to see the mob battle its way through the Capitol Police and vandalize the Capitol, the violence really should not have been a surprise. And so I think, you know, we have been sounding the alarm for months about Trump supporters' threats of violence if he were not reelected. And, you know, on our on the Right Wing Watch site, you can find, you know, a lot of coverage of the lead up to the election, and particularly then after the election, where this so-called Stop the Steal movement really brought together these disparate elements of the religious right, sort of the Trump Republican right, and the far right, and the overtly violent right. You know, we had in November, one of the rallies that happened after the election of people trying to overturn the election, you know, where they talked about if they won a second civil war, they got one. I found it most striking, a rally that was billed as a prayer rally on the National Mall right there by the Washington Monument, that had a mixture of really right-wing religious groups, religious speakers, but also people like Alex Jones, conspiracy theorist from InfoWars, and Stuart Rhodes, who heads this militia group, the Oath Keepers. And, you know, there on the main stage, he wasn't hiding anywhere. This was December 12th. Stuart Rhodes said if Trump did not use his powers as commander in chief to declare martial law and stay in power, that it would force groups like his to wage bloody civil war. And he repeated that threat, you know, in writing and in public. And that was, you know, that was weeks before the insurrection. Then the day before the insurrection on Freedom Plaza, which in Washington, D.C. is a plaza that sits along Pennsylvania Avenue between the White House and the Capitol. Nice view of the Capitol. Again, it was a day-long rally that had the same kind of toxic mix of Christian nationalists who, you know, who really viewed Trump as anointed by God and Trump's opponents as demonic and as fighting the will of God. The leader of the Stop the Steal movement, sort of alt activist who came out of the alt-right, a guy named Ali Alexander, you know, led chants of victory or death. And 1776 is not an option. The chant of 1776 is a popular one among Stop the Steal activists. And you had we had Che An, who comes out of this Dominionist Pentecostal movement, a California pastor with a global following. You know, he told the crowd at that rally on the 5th that this was the most important week in America's history, and that the people were going to rise up and throw Jezebel out. Jezebel, a biblical reference to a wicked queen. And he said, we're going to rule and reign through President Trump and under the lordship of Jesus Christ. We are here to change history. So that was the day before the insurrection. Anyway, so there's still not been a full accounting of all the intelligence failures and bad decisions that were made about securing the Capitol. And it's important, I think, that we work to continue holding people accountable for lying about the election and trying to overturn the will of the voters. You know, someone like Tony Perkins, the head of the Anti-Gay Family Research Council, you know, he was one of the people who came out after the insurrection, sort of denounced violence and said, we don't support violence. But I haven't heard him or anyone on the religious right give any thought to how their rhetoric contributed to this violence, the rhetoric that said, if Joe Biden's elected, it will literally be the end of religious freedom in America and the end of the republic itself. The rhetoric that Trump was anointed by God and that his opponents were demonic. I mean, that kind of rhetoric it's harmful to democracy. It makes it very hard to work across the aisle and find political compromises. I mean, how can you compromise with someone who you've been telling people is an agent of Satan, right? It's very hard. It's very poisonous kind of rhetoric we see by the folks who want to portray all elections as spiritual warfare. So, I have plenty of war stories about religious right events I've covered. So, but I will skip those for now. We can just say a couple continuing concerns and threats that we're looking at today, and then I'll stop. One is continued organizing by extremists, some of whom have been kicked off platforms like Twitter and Facebook, and who are now creating and organizing on new right-wing social media platforms, Parler, Telegram, Clubhouse. My colleagues have done some great reporting on those at Right Wing Watch. The continual rhetoric of on Christian media of you know, the election as spiritual warfare, Trump as God's chosen. We still have people out there who you know, continue to say that the prophecies that they had made about God putting Trump back in office are going to come true. There's you know, right-wing political organizing at state and national levels. A lot of the QAnon activists and Stop the Steal activists are now pouring their energies into local and state-level elections to purge people from the Republican Party that were not sufficiently loyal to Trump, who were not embracing all the lies about the election. We are concerned, as law enforcement officials are, about the infiltration of law enforcement by white nationalists and militia folks. And in addition to the big lie of the stolen election being used to justify new voter suppression laws, you know, there's the emerging another related big lie, which is that the January 6th insurrection wasn't such a big thing, is being overblown by media, and that's a way to really, I think, avoid accountability for the folks that helped bring us to that. And then, you know, we have all the anti-trans legislation, which a lot of it is using the same smears that have always been used against gay and queer people, that we are threats to children, and that using that kind of inflammatory and dangerous rhetoric. I was going to mention just a couple Iowa-specific things. You know, I recently watched a white nationalist America First political action conference held by people who were too far right for CPAC, the annual conservative political action conference. And Steve King was one of the speakers. And one of his war stories was talking about using his campaign funds to help defeat those Supreme Court justices in Iowa who had backed marriage equality in one of the early states to do so. And it was, I was watching an Iowa religious right event, actually a pastor's, an event organized by this National Christian Nationalist Political Operative, David Lane, when I first became aware of Dan and Ferris Wilkes, who are a couple of Texas brothers who became fracking billionaires and have used their fortune to become really huge funders of the religious right movement. And, I've written about them a number of times and steered reporters to resources on them. And I learned about them through the organizing that was going on in Iowa. So I'll stop there. I've been talking for a long time. And oops, there's my dog. And I hope we can happy to answer any questions or have a conversation.
I want to just say... you can post comments or unmute your mic to avoid talking over each other. I'll try to call on people, and I'll ask our Vice President, Ryan Crane, to assist. Hit the chat button on the bottom of your screen, and you'll see links and the ability to post things. So now, any questions, please? Well, I mean, you covered a lot of things. I think it's very interesting and frightening, and that people are radicalizing our country.
Jim Flansburg asked a question in chat, and
okay, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And his question was, "I'm ready to jump out a window." Anything positive going on?
Yes, that's a good news.
Sentiment shared by many of us. So go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, welcome to my world. I think that there are a lot of positive things happening. One was the election in 2020 of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. You know, a lot of people, including myself, were very skeptical that we could defeat Donald Trump because as polarizing as he was, he also really electrifies his own supporters, as we still see. He's a cult figure for many of them. So I think it was an extraordinary accomplishment of organizing, you know, and in some key states, really organizing by Black-led organizations to really bring up the turnout of voters that gave us, you know, Joe Biden instead of President Trump. And then again, extraordinary organizing that took place in Georgia. I mean, who would have thought a few years ago that Georgia would be the state that would keep us from having a Senate continue to be controlled by Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, and would give us a Senate that would actually work with Joe Biden rather than spending its time trying to stop everything. So I thought that was, I mean, that was another one where I frankly didn't expect that we were actually going to pull it off. I mean, we worked hard in Georgia, but, so I think we have some real examples of the impact that can be made by progressive organizing. And that's partly why we're seeing such a backlash, and we're seeing some of these new efforts to restrict voting and voter registration, because, you know, folks on the right don't want to see that deployed again. And, you know, I mean, to me, one of the most important things about getting Trump out of office was to put a break in his appointment of judges. You know, he and the Republican Senate were just, you know, filling the federal courts with some of the most unqualified and ideological judges that are going to be wreaking havoc for a long time. But if he'd had another 4 years to do that, our courts would have just looked so dramatically different. And, you know, there have been some surprises from the courts on the gay rights front and other fronts. But I think, you know, the long-term trend is that the right legal movement has been doing is clear. And again, it's very clear that right-wing legal organizations who are huge and massively funded, you know, they have a real long-term view and they have strategic views, and they are not content to just stop further progress. They want to roll back the clock on us. They want to roll back marriage equality. They want to do away with non-discrimination laws, which they see as unjust infringements on religious freedom. So the threats are real, but our ability to organize is real too. You know, one of the other, you know, there's a wave of really interesting, creative, young elected people who are getting into office around the country. And that also is very hopeful to me. Our Young Elected Officials Network, you can read about some of those people online, just has a lot of great people in them. One of them is a guy who's the mayor of Ithaca, New York, named Svante Myrick. And he just got the city council there to unanimously endorse a really bold public safety initiative that would actually do away with the existing police department and recreate a new Department of Public Safety that would have both armed officers and unarmed officers. So, you know, traffic stops, dealing with someone who's having a mental health crisis would not be facing, you know, would not be turned into armed confrontations that can turn deadly unnecessarily, but people trained to deal with those kind of things. So yeah, I think there's a lot of good things going on out there, and all worthy of our support.
We have some questions. There's two more in the chat. One from John McGowan. Please tell us about the smear job these groups are doing on Black women in leadership roles.
Yeah, there are several high-profile Biden nominees who have had multi-million-dollar campaigns waged against them, a lot of them by a group called JCN, Judicial Crisis Network, which was a group that was during the Trump years, was spending a lot of money to support his judicial nominees. And they have, they spent a lot of money trying to prevent the Senate from confirming Vanita Gupta, who is a civil rights lawyer who was the head of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights until her nomination. She's now the Associate Attorney General. She just, squeaked through the Senate with 51 votes, because the right really mobilized opposition to her. A lot of dishonest, characterizations of her and her record. Right now, we're seeing the same thing happen to Kristen Clark. Kristen Clark, who started her career in the Civil Rights Division, has gone on to work in, the New York Attorney General's office. Just a stellar kind of career as a civil rights lawyer. The person you would want leading the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department. And they're waging an all-out campaign, to smear her based on stuff she did when she was in college, based on mischaracterizations of her record. So she has not yet been confirmed. We hope that'll happen soon. They waged some attacks on, other women of color, Deb Haaland, who is now the Interior Secretary, so that's some of what's been going on. So Vinita Gupta has been confirmed. They're currently focusing a lot of their fire on Kristen Clark, who we hope will be confirmed soon to head the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department. And I think, we also see that they're now targeting some of the, women of color who have been, among Joe Biden's first crop of judicial nominees.
Okay. That's frightening information. Gary Moore had a question. I know the religious right set a goal of training conservative lawyers, which we saw realized under Trump. Your comment about infiltration of law enforcement is really scary. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, there has been a pretty well-documented effort that goes back, a long time, decades, of white nationalists, white supremacists to infiltrate the military and to infiltrate law enforcement. Sometimes it's encouraging people to go spend a couple years in the military because of the training they will get, training and weapons and strategy and things like that. Early in my public interest career, I worked for, Common Cause, which had a magazine back then. Back in the late 80s, they were reporting on, the fact that some, members of the military at Fort Bragg, I think it was Fort Bragg, were actually, selling weapons under the table to, local members of the Ku Klux Klan. So, those ties have been out there. Now with specifically with group like Oath Keepers, who actively recruit among current and former law enforcement and military members, there's a lot of concern among military leadership itself, among law enforcement leaders, how to identify and deal with extremism in the ranks. There was something extraordinary that during the whole, period between the insurrection and the inauguration of Joe Biden, there were questions about whether, some people in the National Guard were sort of pulled out of duty because of some of their what had been discovered on their social media, their affiliations with extreme groups. So this is a concern that's documented from within the military and within law enforcement and the existence of white supremacists and other extremism in the ranks. And I think people are trying to figure out the best way to handle it, but it's certainly important to be aware of.
Okay, let's see. I was just going to post a question. I think that's the last one in the chat.
Yeah, we have that's your question, Byron. There you go.
Yeah. Will the Republican Party be split with Trump supporters and those who feel he is a threat to our democracy? Liz Cheney.
No, it's an interesting question. When you see what's happening to Liz Cheney right now, where it seems that she's about to be purged from her leadership position, where other members of the Republican leadership are endorsing the movement to purge her, basically because she won't fall in line with the lie that this election was stolen from Trump. I mean, that's that is the current article of faith that she's violating on the right. That doesn't say, that doesn't offer a lot of optimism for, you know, people of goodwill, and principle within the Republican Party. Now, she's not the only one. There are certainly others out there. You know, there were, courageous members of Congress who supported, the second impeachment of Donald Trump over the insurrection. There were, Republicans in Congress who did not go along with efforts to, overturn the election by, rejecting the electoral college votes of battleground states that Biden won. But, you know, they were really quite in the minority. And I think it's going to be really, we're going to see in 2022 that, Trump and his, supporters are going to very actively go after everybody who they see as a traitor. And that's their language. The traitors in the Republican Party, like Liz Cheney, like everybody who voted for his impeachment, like everybody who did not vote to overturn the election results, and they're going to try to take them out in the primaries. And, you know, we'll see how successful they are, but it's certainly, I certainly think that, the people in the Republican Party who have more of a traditional view, who are committed to the Constitution and the rule of law, who are not sort of bought into the cult of Trump, I think they have a very, tough road ahead of them because, Trump is not going away. He is, you know, mobilizing his supporters, and these other groups out there are mobilizing his supporters. And, so I think, I don't know what the Republican Party is going to look like. But I think it's not going to be pretty, you know, at least for the immediate future. And just the fact that the, in so many places across the country that the response to the election has been, we're going to find ways to make it harder to vote. You know, not, you know, let's find ways to, you know, get the voters that, that supported Joe Biden, but let's just make sure that in future elections, more of those people can't vote or have a harder time voting.
And that's why it's a threat to our democracy. Voting is the foundation of a democracy. And it's amazing that they're doing that.
Absolutely. And that's one reason I was just going to say that's one reason that there's such a priority being put by People for the American Way and a whole raft of progressive allied groups to try to pass this For the People Act, which is sort of a set of pro-democracy reforms, campaign finance reforms, and voting rights reforms that would overturn some of these state level restrictions on voting. And that's gonna be a big fight, and that's gonna, you know, lead us into a fight over the future of the filibuster. And so there's a lot going on there, but
We have one question that I'm afraid we skipped over Scott Cugno, and I apologize for that, or Scott and Jonathan. What efforts are in place to collaborate with other like-minded organizations? And I know you've hit on that, but that question coming specifically to you there.
Yeah, no, there's a tremendous amount of collaboration in Washington and around the country among progressive organizations. There are coalitions working on democracy issues, like voting rights. There are, you know, collaborations of organizations working against anti-immigrant, legislation and rhetoric that's out there. There are coalitions working on, you know, each of these important areas on religious liberty issues and church state. So yeah, there's a very collaborative, movement on all of these issues and across these issues, on our side of that. And that's really needed.
There's another question from Gary Moore. The fact that 70% of Republicans believe that Biden is an illegitimate president supposedly is scary. Republicans present leadership. The Republicans present leadership does not want anyone talking about those threats to democracy, but only regaining power.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, that's why, you know, the idea of saying whatever you need to say to win elections, you know, that's kind of a cynical political operative way to look at the world. And it is dangerous. You know, I mean, one of the ways that Trump got elected in 2016 was that Christian groups and Christian media, conservative Christian media, told millions of people that if Hillary Clinton was elected, Christianity was going to be criminalized in the United States, that her judges would do away. I mean, just ridiculous, ridiculous things. But millions of people heard that from people they trusted. And so they really, that's part of how Trump became this, you know, seen as this champion of religious freedom and this, you know, God anointed, Cyrus, that was going to lead America back to God, you know, and at the same time, and then since he got in office and put people like Paula White in the White House, where she constantly referred to his opponents as demonic and, his opponents as, you know, agents of Satan. And if you really believe your opponents are agents of Satan, you know, how are you going to work with them? In the same way, repeating over and over and over again that this election was illegitimate, that, that the, Trump won the election by a landslide. You know, some people, you know, claim this was a landslide, a historic landslide that was stolen from him, you know, by all kinds of nefarious, means. It does poison the electorate. So you do have a lot of people now who see Biden as an illegitimate president, and who say, you know, they'll never accept him. They'll never accept him as president. So if that's the dominant voice in the party, that explains why you have so few members of Congress willing to stand up to him. You have, you know, relatively few Liz Cheney's out there willing to just say, you know, this stolen election stuff is bullshit and it's dangerous bullshit. But, you know, for the most part, there are very few of those, voices of courage right now in the party.
Well, we're just about out of time. We might take one more question, but I don't see anything else in the chat. So if anyone has anything, please bring it up now.
Yeah, so I'll, unless something comes up, I'll encourage people, people for the American Way's website and Religious Right, and the Right Wing Watch is its own website, rightwingwatch.org, where you can just follow our reporting and analysis on the right. I encourage you to check all of those out.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Peter. This is a lot of actually mostly frightening information. Unfortunately, I had never heard of JCM that worked to pack our courts with conservative judges. So there's always organizations behind the scene that we don't hear about that are a threat. People for the American Way serves as an important check on conservative movement that seems to have hijacked religious groups and the Republican Party in our country. It's disheartening that the LGBTQ community seems to be the target, a target in their campaign to conquer and divide our country. The reality of this radicalism has become that it has become a real threat to our democracy. You can learn more about People for American Way at PFAW.org. I have a few reminders. A reminder about the One Iowa LGBTQ Older Adults Conference on May 18th. Go to oneiowa.org to learn more and register for the virtual event. And also the Opera Fellow Travelers on July 17th. Go to Des Moines Metro Opera.org to learn more. Upcoming speakers, June 4th will be Reverend Jim Conrad, Town View Baptist Church in Georgia, that is an open and welcoming congregation and expelled by the Southern Baptist Convention. Mm-hmm. Also note that is not our annual awards for scholars. We've moved it to July. And announced previously, we will focus on the Lavender Scare, which was the federal government's official response to both a visible lesbian and gay community and a perceived homosexual menace. Normalized persecution of homosexuals through bureaucratic institutionalization of homophobic discrimination policy. So in the chat button, you will see links to One Iowa, Des Moines Metro, Gay Men's Chorus, People for the American Way, the Des Moines Metro Opera. You can see more about the Fellow Travelers Opera. You can save the chat by hitting the three dots at the bottom of the chat window. That's a little hidden feature. And then you'll have those links available or hit them and see them before you close the Zoom window. So that is all we have this morning. Thank you everyone for joining us, and our meeting is now adjourned.
Everybody.
Thank you, Peter.